Frank fights dirty. Quote, "They say that nigger couldn't lie. Gentlemen, if there is any one thing that nigger can do, it is to lie." End quote. Reuben Arnold, Leo Frank's attorney, closing argument. James Jim Conley effectively knitted together the hard facts with a story that struck Atlantans as the first believable explanation of Confederate Day's tragic events. The pieces of circumstantial evidence Prosecutor Dorsey had assembled now had a narrator, someone who could, and did, breathe life into the prosecution's theory of the crime. The parade of young white girls onto the witness stand added the mortar, and had the subliminal effect of reminding everyone of the travails of murder victim Mary Fagan. Assistant Prosecutor Frank Hooper was brimming with confidence and promoting Conley as if he were managing a prize fighter. Quote, "Mr. Rosser will go ahead and wear himself out, and Attorney Arnold will hurl questions at Conley until he, too, grows weary, and when it is all over, the Negro will still be there ready for more." End quote. The, quote, "Negroes," end quote, steadfast adherence to the truth as he saw it, and his ability, when pressed, to produce ever more and convincing detail, forced Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold to abandon any judicial decorum and commence a bare-knuckled racist brawl. Thus, for the first time, the Jewish defendant introduced open racial bigotry into the courtroom. Certainly, Conley's rendition had to be refuted, but the Frank team went much further than that. Conley became the channel through which Frank's enormous legal brigade would heap slanderous, Hamitic invective upon the entire black race. According to one writer, Luther Rosser's courtroom statements about Conley, quote, "were the most bigoted utterances made during the case," end quote. The silver medal most certainly belonged to Leo Frank's other attorney, Reuben Arnold. And though he endured abuse and savage insults, the Georgian headline told it all. Quote, "Negro's main story still unshaken," end quote. Another announced, quote, "Conley story stands," end quote. Another proclaimed, quote, "Negro cool and unafraid," end quote. The Atlanta Georgian Reporter wrote, quote, "If the story Conley tells is a lie, then it is the most inhumanly devilish, the most cunningly clever, and the most amazingly sustained lie ever told in Georgia," end quote. Said another reporter, quote, "If so much as 5% of his story was true, it would suffice to convict Frank," end quote. The general belief of Georgians was expressed by Governor John Slayton himself. Quote, "It is hard to conceive that any man's power of fabrication, of minute detail, could reach that which Conley showed, unless it be the truth," end quote. It was, in the end, an, quote, "ingenious narrative," end quote, declared the Atlanta Journal. Quote, "He," end quote, "Conley," quote, "had every circumstance and feature of this story clear in his mind, and not once during the 16.5 hours that he was in the witness chair did he admit that any portion of it was false, notwithstanding the terrific bombardment of questions hurled at him on cross-examination. But the question which presents itself most persistently is, could this illiterate Negro have conceived and fitted together such a set of detailed circumstances without some foundation in fact?" End quote. The beleaguered defense attorneys countered by parading dozens of Jewish witnesses, some from Frank's college days who traveled hundreds of miles to testify to Frank's moral rectitude, but none of them were able to address the specific allegations made by those who saw Frank on a daily basis in his own business environment. Bible-toting Georgians had always held their Jewish neighbors in high regard, and Frank's defense team played to that very fact. However, the sentimental advantage his Jewishness offered evaporated in front of a jury that was not so willing to overlook those uncontested sexual allegations. He could not overcome the simple fact that, as the Georgian put it, the only, quote, testimony pointing toward the innocence of Frank was that of Frank himself, end quote. The distressed testimony of Frank's young white female employees had the effect of neutralizing the heavy racial overtones of the case. Their word confirmed and superseded that of, quote, the Negroes, end quote, numbing the advantage Frank hoped he would have in a Jim Crow courtroom. The B'nai B'rith president had counted on his ability to portray the sexual assault and murder as a, quote, Negro crime, end quote. But with each successive witness testifying to Frank's sexual aggressiveness, the defense's racial tactics looked less and less like a defense and more like an evasion. Leo Frank's Negro Testimony and Negro Crimes. Quote, I was raised with niggers and know something about them. I do not know them as well as the police, perhaps, for they know them like no one else. But I know something about them. End quote. Luther Z. Rosser, Leo Frank's attorney. Quote, it's a nigger crime, gentlemen. It's a nigger crime. End quote. Reuben Arnold, Leo Frank's attorney. Frank had been arrested and charged with the murder of Mary Fagan before Conley's explosive revelations came to light. But Frank's elite attorneys, Herbert Haas, Luther Rosser, and Reuben Arnold, made a calculated decision that their client's fate would hinge on an aggressive introduction of what would generations later become known as, quote, the race card, end quote. This was not a difficult decision in the Deep South, where the deck itself contained nothing but race cards. So when the defenders of the B'nai B'rith president focused their sights squarely on, quote, the Negro, end quote, James Conley, it was a natural, even obvious, ploy. In actuality, the racial targeting by the Frank forces began with their merciless scapegoating of Newt Lee, and before that, with Frank himself when he composed the, quote, murder notes, end quote, which were intended to lead police to a, quote, long, tall, black Negro, end quote. And by insisting that the murder occurred in the basement, where the factory's, quote, Negro toilet, end quote, was, Frank was implicitly connecting the crime to black men. The Frank team wanted to capitalize on early reports like the one in the Atlanta Georgian about a week after the murder titled, quote, Old Police Reporter Analyzes Mystery. Public Suspected Negro. It was perfectly clear on Sunday and Monday last that the public was willing to put the extraordinary act in the category known as Negro crimes, and the sentiment of the streets was that Lee was guilty or knew the guilty man. The Fagan case is not a white man's crime, or if it is a white man's crime, it is extraordinary and most unusual. End quote. The Frank team relied on the Jewish defendant's status as a privileged white man in a racially divided and racially diluted society. Never before in the Jim Crow South had a black man's testimony been accepted over that of a white man's, and certainly never in a trial of a white man. Frank's attorneys seized upon the state's extraordinary blurring of the color line to make their stand. They looked beyond the murder of Mary Fagan and took the position that Frank's conviction would in fact undermine sacred Southern racial traditions and set in motion a racial upheaval far more significant than Frank's actual guilt or innocence. Frank's team determined that the very nature of the two races would have to be juxtaposed, just as the 1925 Scopes trial would juxtapose monkey and man, in order to suggest the impossibility of a white man as the murderer of Mary Fagan. It was a blatant Jewish appeal to white race unity. For as one Leo Frank case historian wrote, quote, racial assumptions often acted as the glue that held Southern society together, end quote. And in pursuit of that profoundly racist stratagem, Conley and his race became the subject and the focus of a bitter character assassination. It was a racist crusade that began in the courtroom and continued in the Jewish American press, and has been carried out for decades hence by pro-Frank historians, journalists, and activists. Frank's defense, in every respect, was shaped to resemble another vital American judicial function in that time. The lynching of black people was an integral part of American culture, largely because it had a unifying effect on the community of lynchers. The pure brutality of it seemed to revive a group-hunting instinct among the mobs of whites who participated in these culturally sanctioned human sacrifices. It served both a psychological and a political need to spill the blood of any black, quote, intruder, end quote, on white racial hegemony, and thus kept all blacks terrorized and anchored to their designated place at the basement of American society. Frank's trial lawyers would try to arouse this anti-black fervor in that Georgia courtroom and direct it against the black, quote, intruder, end quote, James Conley. The first step was to remind Atlantans that white supremacy was the supreme law of the land and a founding principle that was, especially in this case, getting dangerously frayed around the edges. Second, Leo Frank's lawyers reasserted there was in fact, and should continue to be, a specific category of evidence known as, quote, Negro testimony, end quote. This inferior class of evidence had long been recognized in the Southern legal system for the express purpose of devaluing black humanity in the eyes of the law. This was more than punitive bigotry. It was, in fact, how American society financed itself and raised the standard of living for its white citizenry, especially for its wealthiest subgroup, Southern Jews. Such a uniquely American doctrine provided a legal umbrella of protection for every manner of racial wickedness. Merchants could and did cheat blacks at will. Employers could and did refuse to pay them. Bloody violence could be and was perpetrated against blacks. Land, homes, crops, labor, tools, mules could be and were taken from them. All without any legal recourse for the black victims, their testimony in any court completely null and void. This legal doctrine protected the white rapists of black women and girls, whose resulting black children could not sue for inheritance from their white fathers. The repeal of this incredibly profitable link in the slaves' chains, which is what Frank argued Conley's testimony represented, would usher in an entirely new and disastrous dynamic in race relations. Rabbi Max Heller spoke for American Jews in their most prominent newspaper, The American Israelite. Quote, "One finds it difficult to believe that an intelligent white jury would, unhesitatingly and unqualifiedly, find a verdict of capital punishment against a respectable man upon the virtually unsupported testimony of a low type of Negro. One could not but feel, under the circumstances, that one's faith in American manhood and American civilization would totter." End quote. Thus, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, had to be dismissed out of hand, for no other reason than its dangerous potential to overturn the status quo. Luther Rosser spoke for his client, Leo Frank, at the retrial hearing. Quote, "When has the word of an African been better than the word of one Anglo-Saxon woman? The doctrine that an African's word is more to be relied upon than that of an Anglo-Saxon woman dies with this case." End quote. The Constitution recorded this part of Rosser's rant. Quote, "They would rather believe the Negro's word. They took it in preference, and, in believing it, put the nasty brand of liar on a sweet little white girl. Oh, how times have changed. I hope to God I die before they change any worse than this." And these 12 good men wrapped their arms lovingly and tenderly around this stinking black brute, saying, "We love you, Jim, we love you." End quote. And when whites provided damaging testimony, as did C.B. Dalton, Attorney Rosser performed the obligatory racial damage control. Quote, "Here is this man, Dalton, of the Anglo-Saxon race. Yes, gentlemen of the jury, he had a white face, but that was all. He was black within." End quote. Obviously, their arguing to exclude testimony by people with black skin put the Jews in the trickiest of moral predicaments. Just a few years into the future, they would rally world outrage on their behalf against the very same alleged discriminations in Nazi Germany. Yet here, in an American courtroom, it was Jews who sought to reinforce those very same racist policies for their own behalf. Frank himself voiced his belief that not only was James Conley a liar, but he came from, quote, "a lying race," end quote, of people. Quote, "Here is a Negro, not alone with the shiftless and lying habits of an element of his race that is common to the South," end quote. What's more, Frank's attempts to reestablish the doctrine of, quote, "Negro testimony," end quote, for his Southern interrogators only laid the foundation from which to advance his even more insidious bigotry. The canard that there existed a specific category of transgressions called, quote, "Negro crimes," end quote, a category into which the murder of Mary Fagan fit neatly and exclusively. A May 31st Atlanta Constitution front-page headline, unmistakable in its clear reference to Frank's own thinking, announced, quote, "Mary Fagan's murder was work of a Negro, declares Leo M. Frank," end quote. It quoted the B'nai B'rith leader, quote, "No white man killed Mary Fagan. It's a Negro's crime through and through. No man with common sense would even suspect I did it," end quote. Frank's attorney, Reuben Arnold, followed suit, drawing tidy race and class distinctions. Quote, "Why go further than this black wretch there by the elevator shaft, fired with liquor, fired with lust and crazy for money? Why, they rob and ravish every day in the most peculiar and shocking way. But this man's race," end quote, pointing to Frank, quote, "don't kill. They are not a violent race. Some of them may be immoral, but they go no further than that," end quote. Clearly, he continued, quote, "the murder was the unreasoning crime of a Negro," end quote. Arnold declared, quote, "I want to call your attention later to the class of their witnesses and the class of ours. The crime isn't an act of a civilized man. It's the crime of a cannibal, a man-eater. This crime is the hideous act of a Negro who would ravish a 10-year-old girl the same as he would ravish a woman of years. It isn't a white man's crime. It's the crime of a beast, a low, savage beast," end quote. With his Jewish client looking on approvingly, Arnold warned his audience of white male jurors about the dangers of black men. Quote, "There are 1,000 of them in Atlanta who would assault a white woman if they had the chance and knew they wouldn't get caught," end quote. This approach was calculated to capitalize on the fervor that was then sweeping through the nation. The fear of, quote, "Negro domination," end quote. Candidates for titles and positions, big and small, jousted with each other over who was best qualified to enforce Negro inferiority in all affairs, with particular focus on weakening black voting power. The newspapers were filled with chest-thumping whites waving their curricula vitae, proving who was the quickest to tie a noose around black political and economic progress. Arnold and Rosser easily worked that angle into their defense of Leo Frank. Frank's advocates reached for yet a third distinct layer of race treachery. By the state of Georgia's acceptance of black testimony, they maintained, it turned the Frank case from a simple criminal prosecution to an, quote, "anti-Semitic," end quote, persecution. Reuben Arnold, quote, I'll tell you right now, if Frank hadn't been a Jew, there would never have been any prosecution against him. I'm asking my own people to turn him loose, asking them to do justice to a Jew. And I'm not a Jew, but I would rather die before doing injustice to a Jew. End quote. Scholar of the case, Leonard Dinnerstein, unwittingly confirms this point when he wrote that anti-Semitism in Atlanta is, quote, evident in the widespread acceptance of Negro Jim Conley's testimony, end quote. Here, even a Jewish scholar, writing after the civil rights movement, which was said to have reformed such notions, considers it a sign of, quote, anti-Semitism, end quote, when the civil rights of a black person are respected in an American courtroom. In Dinnerstein's construction, there is no room for the veracity of the black witness or for the fairness of white Gentile jurors and officials. Nor can or should the acceptance of black testimony be seen as a significant breakthrough in American jurisprudence. Nor does Dinnerstein invalidate every previous case in an American courtroom, as Jewish scholars would invalidate any Nazi court proceeding as intrinsically fraudulent. The heretofore immutable principle of white-only testimony, by Dinnerstein's calculation, is a reasonable status quo. The extension of Dinnerstein's argument is that in any instance where, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, is given any credence in cases affecting Jews, it is, by definition, anti-Semitism. Prominent American Jews with reputations as racial liberals were drawn in to support the racist paradigm of, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, and, quote, Negro crimes, end quote. Rabbi Stephen Wise of New York was one of the foremost Jews in America and a supporter of the NAACP. In reference to the Frank case, Wise insisted that crimes against women are, quote, rarely, if ever, end quote, committed by Jews. An assertion intended to mean, of course, that such outrages are common to other races, namely James Conley's race. Ironically, Jews were at that moment the undisputed masters of the international prostitution trade, known as, quote, white slavery, end quote. Frank's defense team had bared their teeth and let loose a blistering barrage of racial invective. With Frank looking on, Rosser called Conley a, quote, dirty nigger, end quote, and a, quote, disreputable Negro ex-convict, end quote, and referred to him as, quote, bestial, end quote, and, quote, filthy, end quote, and as a, quote, savage, end quote, and a, quote, brute, end quote. Reuben Arnold went beyond the individual black witness before him and asserted, quote, every Southern man knows that Negroes can make up gruesome stories, end quote. Conley, he said, was, quote, a perpetual lawbreaker who has a law-breaking race back of him, end quote. In reference to the murder notes found next to Mary Fagan's body, Arnold raged, quote, these notes are Negro notes from beginning to end, in thought, in composition, in everything. The savage mind acts in strange, devious, peculiar ways. The educated mind does not. They are idiotic and ridiculous, except to an ignorant, darkened mind. Here we have a note so obscure, so couched in the dark vernacular of the Negro. He says it was all dictated by Frank, too. That our Southern policemen who corral these Negroes daily, who deal with them and who play with them like you would with cards on a table, can't understand it. Everyone is groping in the darkness until Newt Lee sees it. Newt Lee, a Negro whose mental operations are the same as Jim Conley's. A white man goes by his intelligence, by his logic, by his discernment. A Negro goes largely by his instinct, and occasionally it is strikingly correct. End quote. And thus, the Negro notes led ipso facto to the Negro crime. Quote, "Well, the little girl," end quote, "Mary," quote, "entered, and she got her pay and asked about the medal, and then she left. But there was a black spider waiting down there near the elevator shaft, a great passionate, lustful animal. He was as full of vile lust as he was of the passion for more whiskey," end quote. Conley was not shown to have been drunk on the day of the murder, and in light of testimony from his cook, Mrs. Manola McKnight, and his friend, Mr. C. Brutus Dalton, inebriation seemed more descriptive of the defendant, Leo Frank. Nor is there any testimony that Conley ever used cocaine, yet the venerable Luther Z. Rosser declared, quote, "Is it possible that you Anglo-Saxon men have forgotten the nature of the Negro? Conley is a plain, beastly, ragged, filthy, lying nigger. Have I overstated that? Conley is a plain, dirty, filthy, lying, drunken, and probably lousy nigger. They got a dirty black Negro, and in order to give impetus to his testimony, they had a barber cut his hair and shave him. And they gave him a bath. And he came in here like a slicked onion. Whoever played that trick was unworthy of the name white man. Why didn't they let you see him as he was, with his spreading nose through which probably tons of cocaine have been sniffed?" End quote. And when Conley did not recall whether he had finished his breakfast on a day 4 months before, Luther Rosser snorted, quote, "Don't you know a nigger never had sausage on the table without eating it?" End quote. Sneering at Conley, he fumed, quote, "They put some clean clothes on you, didn't they, so the jury could see you like a dressed-up nigger?" End quote. He turned to the jury and summed up their task. Quote, "That white men should believe this infamous character," end quote. Jim Conley, quote, "is a shame on this great city and this great state, and will be to the end of time," end quote. And though the Georgian reported that Luther Rosser referred to Conley, quote, "with unsparing epithets," end quote, the Jewish defendant, quote, "shook hands with," end quote, "Rosser," quote, "warmly, and congratulated him upon his speech," end quote. Night watchman Newt Lee was exonerated of any role in the crime, but Frank's team, throughout the trial and long after, continued to insist that Lee had played some part in the murder. They had even planted a bloody shirt in his home to, quote, "help," end quote, the investigation along. Luther Rosser, in referring to the characteristics of that bloody shirt, had this exchange with the medical expert in open court. Question. The shirt had the odor of blood on it when you first got it, didn't it? Answer. Yes. Question. Then, wouldn't the odor of blood have killed the odor of nigger? Answer. No. Question. Then, if a nigger had just put on his shirt and had taken it off in an instant, your nose would get him? Answer. Have you ever smelled a Negro, Mr. Rosser? Rosser. More than you ever smelled. I was smelling them before you were born. As president of B'nai B'rith, Leo Frank was arguably the most important Jew in Georgia. Yet his courtroom defense would become one of the most racist ever recorded in the history of the American judicial system. And whilst scholars have insisted that, quote, anti-Semitic, end quote, lynch mobs were lusting for the blood of the Jewish Leo Frank, the incredible fact is that Frank himself was quite willing to stoke a racial climate so dangerous and volatile that the white Gentile mayor of Atlanta had to take special measures to prevent the black man's lynching. Jeffrey Melnick said the Frank team waged, quote, a virulent racist offense, end quote. And their attempts to vindicate Frank, he wrote, quote, ultimately validated the process of racial scapegoating itself, end quote. Their raging about, quote, black beast rapists, end quote, and other vicious stereotypes, quote, became a familiar feature of pro-Frank discourse, end quote. They, quote, capitalized on much the same sort of racist thinking that helped to turn public opinion against their man, end quote. The supporters of Leo Frank, quote, proved willing to employ racist thinking to condemn Jim Conley while often simultaneously decrying the similar sentiments that contributed to Frank's conviction, end quote. Theodore Rosengarten lamented, quote, readers who wish to find a progressive Jewish social ethic at work in the Frank camp will be sorely disappointed. Frank's lawyers played the race card for all it was worth. End quote. Leo Frank takes the stand. Quote, like a dull knife, just ain't cutting, just talking loud and saying nothing. End quote. James Brown. The jury, now awash in the unseemly realities of Leo Frank's private life, anticipated an explanation directly from the man himself. And on August 18th, the defendant took the stand in his own defense. But he did so under a strange anomaly of Georgia law that made him impervious to cross-examination. Under the law, a, quote, prisoner, end quote, had the right to make a statement in court, but he would not have to be sworn on the Bible or cross-examined by the prosecutor. In effect, Frank would be able to say anything to the jury on any topic. He would not even have to speak about the case at all, and prosecutor Hugh Dorsey would have no role except as spectator. Nonetheless, on August 17th, the Georgian gave the event advance billing, posting a big banner headline. Quote, Leo Frank is ready to reveal his story. What this statement will be, the defendant's lawyers themselves profess not to know. End quote. Though Frank's attorneys informed the press that he had been preparing his statement since the trial began. The Georgian expected that Frank would, quote, appeal to the reason and common sense of the 12 men, end quote. And though the newspaper sympathetically reported that he, quote, made his own best witness, end quote, that sentiment turned out to be woefully optimistic. In the 4 hours of his exhaustively rehearsed monologue, Frank approached his last opportunity for redemption in a most curious manner. With all ears open to him as never before, he treated Atlanta to a litany of technocratic details about his daily work routine, giving a bare minimum of attention to the capital murder charge against him. He took the jury through the eye-glazing, mind-numbing details of factory management and administration, point by tedious point, a sample of which follows. Quote, of all the mathematical work in the office of the pencil factory, this very operation, this very piece of work that I have now before me, is the most important. It is the invoice covering shipments that are sent to customers, and it is very important that the prices be correct, that the amount of goods shipped agrees with the amount which is on the invoice, and that the terms are correct, and that the address is correct. And also in some cases, I don't know whether there is one like that here, there are freight deductions, all of which have to be very carefully checked over and looked into, because I know of nothing else that exasperates a customer more than to receive invoices that are incorrect. Moreover, on this morning, this operation of this work took me longer than it usually takes an ordinary person to complete the checking of the invoices, because usually one calls out and the other checks. But I did this work all by myself that morning, and as I went over these invoices, I noticed that Miss Eubanks, the day before, had evidently sacrificed accuracy to speed, and every one of them was wrong. So I had to go alone over the whole invoice, and I had to make the corrections as I went along, figure them out, extend them, make deductions for freight, if there were any to be made, and then get the total shipments. Because when these shipments were made on April 24th, which was Thursday, this was the last day of our fiscal week. It was on this that I made that financial sheet, which I make out every Saturday afternoon, as has been my custom. It is on this figure of total shipments I make that out. So necessarily, it would be the total shipments for the week that had to be figured out. and I had to figure every invoice and arrange it in its entirety so I could get a figure that I would be able to use. The first order here is from Hilton, Hart & Kern Company, Detroit, Michigan. Here is the original order, which is in the file of our office. Here is the transcription, which was made on March 28th. It hadn't been shipped until April 24th. This customer ordered 100 gross of number 2 of a certain pencil stamped the Packard Motor Car Company, 125 gross of number 3, and 50 gross of number 4. Those figures represent the grade or hardness of the lead in the pencils. We shipped 100 gross of number 2, 111 and a quarter gross of number 3, and 49 gross of number 4. The amount of the shipment of number 3 is short of the amount the customer ordered, therefore there is a suspense shipment card attached to it. As you will notice, the first shipment on this order took place on April 24th. It was a special order and a special imprint on it, and therefore the length of time, order received at the factory on March 18th. End quote. Frank continued as though he believed he was addressing a pencil manufacturer's trade conference. He even brought in a sample case of his pencil product line for the jury to see. What he had intended to accomplish by this long-winded industry exegesis is one of the enduring mysteries of the case. Indeed, the description of young Frank by his four-year college classmates in his 1906 Cornell Senior Class Yearbook was no less than prophecy. Quote, his, end quote, Leo Max Frank's, quote, genius found expression in three-phased generators and foundry work, where he soon gained the reputation of being the champion hot air artist of the university by his happy faculty of talking all day and saying nothing. His services as a debating coach for the Congress debate teams have made him a fame hard to equal. This proficiency as an air shooter will doubtless win Max success as a gas jet. End quote. To be generous, part of his defense relied on the notion that on that Saturday afternoon, Frank was simply too busy preparing complex business reports to commit the murder and the cover-up. His approach seemed designed to establish that point, but every administrative detail Frank felt the jurors should know seemed only to reinforce their view that either he was deluded about the actual purpose of the trial, or he was attempting to conceal his guilt in a barrage of minutiae calculated to belittle or overwhelm their intelligence. And yet, he pressed on in that same self-destructive vein. Jeffrey Melnick is one of the many scholars who considered Frank's statement damaging to his case. Quote, and when he does take the stand, I've read the whole speech and it's gruesome. What Frank decided to focus on. A terrible mistake he made in his own case that he thought what was called for was to talk about the financial workings of the factory. End quote. According to the Anti-Defamation League's internal analysis, quote, his four-hour appearance on the witness stand was disingenuous in the extreme. End quote. Steve Oney, quote, by 4:35, when Judge Roan ordered a brief recess, Frank had been ratcheting on for the better part of 2.5 hours. And while he may have convinced some of those listening that the work he'd done on the financial sheet the afternoon of the murder demanded intense concentration, it's doubtful he persuaded anyone to the related conclusion that he was guiltless. Indeed, the more probable reactions were suspicion and disbelief. Here was a man who, for all his reliance on the precise language of management, seemed to be manifesting a kind of hysteria. Had Frank ended his statement at this juncture, there can be little doubt that it would have been judged an unmitigated disaster. End quote. When he did, finally, focus on the events surrounding the murder, Frank offered no more about his own actions than was already asserted in his pre-trial statements, all of which professed absolute ignorance of any aspect of Mary Fagan's demise. He denied any improper behavior with the factory's female employees or any engagement in after-hour adulteries. He denied, quote, the Negro Conley statement, end quote, or that he had even seen Conley on the day of the murder. And when he had the opportunity to subject himself to questioning as, quote, the Negro Conley, end quote, had, Leo Frank declined. As he left the stand, the handwriting was on the wall. August 25th marked the end of Leo Frank's month-long trial for the murder of Mary Fagan. It took jurors just a few hours to return a guilty verdict in a case that could only be described as a total legal disaster for Leo Max Frank. The weight of the evidence, the inconsistencies in Frank's alibi, James Conley's unshakable testimony, the wave of unchallenged victims of Frank's sexual harassment, Frank's refusal to be questioned or to offer any alternative explanation of the crime, convinced a 12-man jury of fellow white men not only that he was guilty of murder, but that he ought to die. The next day, August 26, 1913, Judge Leonard S. Roan sentenced Leo M. Frank to hang for the murder of Mary Fagan. The execution date was set for October 10, 1913. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.